from 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. Welcome to The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you.
Hello and welcome to The Art of the Matter. I'm Sharon Gamble. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Buscelli Wallerab Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
And I'm Travis DiNicola. Today I'll preview this year's Installation Nation exhibit.
I'll talk with Janet Allen about her 20th anniversary at the IRT and what the new season has in store.
And I'll take a look at the Indianapolis Art Center's summer exhibition, Art from the Heartland. Plus, there'll be that arts calendar we call
What'll We Do? All that and more right after the latest news from NPR. Primary Color's annual Installation Nation show is back at the Indianapolis Art Center Arts Park, this year filling the grounds and trees with temporary outdoor installations. Travis DiNicola spoke with co-chairs Sarah Broadbeck and Megan Reinhardt, as well as participating artist Chad Hankins, to find out more.
Megan, Sarah, Chad, welcome to Art of the Matter. Great to have you here.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us.
Great to be here.
Absolutely. I've been looking forward to this. Always love Installation Nation. Very cool event. Primary Colors has been doing for a number of years. Some people may remember it when it was in the sort of the storage boxcars down off of College. It's been up at the Indianapolis Arts Center for the past few years now and is returning, which is excellent. Let's start with Sarah. You're the vice president of Primary Colors, right?
I am, yes.
Yeah. So what's, give us some background on Primary Colors.
Primary Colors is a great organization with groups of people that really just want to help local artists make a name for themselves. Mm-hmm. It's really nice when you're coming out of college, you've got all these great ideas, but what we're finding is that sometimes it's hard to build that network of buyers to connect themselves with other local artists. So what Primary Colors is trying to do is just bring more local artists into our own backyard and really help promote selling their work to people here in Indianapolis.
And you do that through a number of ways, exhibits, as well as I know you do workshops for artists and networking and things like that as well.
Absolutely. We've got a gallery down in Fountain Square. Mm-hmm. And so we host a number of First Fridays. Sometimes they're individual shows or group shows, depending on the themes that we're doing. So that's a great way. We get about 1,000 visitors, give or take, every First Friday in there.
And some great shows.
Absolutely. Lots mm-hmm. of great shows. And then Installation Nation is another way. You know, we definitely wanted to expand into our for our installation artists. It's not just about the painters here. We've got some great right. installation artists here in the city, and we wanted to explore that and make it a little bit bigger. So we went to the Indianapolis Art Center to give them more room and, you know, 9 acres to figure things out.
Yeah, and it's a great thing. I, like I said, always enjoy Installation Nation. It's always interesting to see what the artists that are part of it sort of do with the parameters of wherever it's located. Mm-hmm. Megan, let me ask you, why installation?
I really like that we focus on installations for, obviously, Installation Nation, because it gives the general public an opportunity to kind of think outside the frame, if you will. Mm-hmm. So you've got families who are coming. They're exposing their children to a new form, not necessarily new, but like a different form that you're not necessarily going to see within the confines of four walls and a gallery.
Sure.
And with 9 acres, you can do a lot. So, of course, the installation aspect is really important. And I lost my
Well, I think what makes this really unique is that it's not inside a gallery. A lot of installations are done inside galleries.
Right.
Like in the past with previous installations, they were done inside the cargo boxes and such. But this is outside, which takes on a whole new element. I mean, the Art Center has a great space and has art that's out there, some permanent, some temporary. But asking artists to create an installation outside really kind of changes everything, because then they have to work with the environment and the light and the elements and all of that. That throws in a whole bunch of challenges. So, Sarah, you're nodding your head there.
Yes, and it's exciting because when we do the request for proposal, I mean, I think we had 95 applicants this year, so
wow.
We really spent some time
that's awesome.
Yeah, going through just what their, you know, what the problem was and how are they going to solve for that and the different types of materials that they're going to use. I mean, we have everything from flags to mirrors to bike pipes to lighting that'll be up in the trees.
Hammocks in the trees, right?
Yeah, we got hammocks in the trees. So it's just a cool collection of, you know, different artists' ideas of what an installation means in the park. And then with people interacting, the artists will be out there asking them questions. We'll have QR codes so they can see the artist statement and go online and get more information that way. So it really is to expand the dialogue. And we want the kids to say, "Mom, what's that? Why are these mirrors here? Or can we get in the hammocks? Can we, you know, can we test it out?"
Can they get in the hammocks?
They can get in the hammocks, yes.
Well, let's talk about the mirrors. Chad, your work that I am aware of is very often experiential. I know, have some great influences. Turner's light work is a great influence, as well as also just the work of magicians and sort of work that creates visual illusions. And you're kind of doing that with this piece that you're creating, right?
Yeah. So one of the main driving forces for how I end up with these art pieces is experimenting with the limitations and properties of certain materials and tools. And so with this piece, I had created work with mirrors and live feed video cameras and still frame cameras, and I posed a challenge to myself to create an interactive piece that requires two people instead of one.
Okay.
So it creates a shared moment instead of just a personal memory.
Describe the piece to me that you're working on.
Okay, so it's a privacy fence, and there's mirrors on both sides of it. And I devised an optical illusion by cutting a slit out of a mirror. And so if you have a partner, and your partner stands on the other side of the fence, and you line your eyes up through the slit in the fence, you see their eyes on your face because you see the rest of your face in the mirror, but their eyes through the slit.
Very cool. Now, will there be like spots there that like show people where to stand or where to look, or how's that work?
I was very fortunate. I've had so much assistance. I'm just learning who all my friends are, you know. Oh my God, I've had at least 10 to 15 people help me with this project. And I had a friend turn one of my drawings into a laser etched signage, so it looks really nice to put on the piece. That it's the title, my name, and then a small illustration of two people peering through the slit, the slices in the mirror, so that it, and then it says line your eyes up with a partner. So I'm hoping that's enough instruction.
Yeah. Now, as we're recording this, you haven't actually installed the piece yet. I know you're still planning on that. But how's your experience been so far? I mean, being part of Installation Nation, because this is your first year as an artist with it, right? I mean, you've done other installations in the past, but not with Installation Nation.
I am so grateful for organizations that pose challenges to artists. It's such an inspiration. Like, this is the first time I've met these ladies, and so we've just been doing everything by email, but just the fact that they're putting this on is, I thrive on challenge and pressure, and so like this kind of event that they're putting together, it makes me a better artist. So, and before I just came up with the privacy fence idea, the title is "A Bit of Me and You." A Bit of Me and You was just a box with mirrors in it, and I knew I wanted to apply that piece to this event, but because it was outdoors, that challenge created the fence.
So let me get this straight. You had an idea for a piece, but it basically sort of came to light because of the challenge of Installation Nation. Is that right? So
yes.
In a way, you kind of created it specifically for Installation Nation.
Yes.
But based on other work. That's very cool. That's a great opportunity then. And also, of course, as you mentioned, the challenges of just dealing with it outside and dealing with the elements and stuff, which I'm sure affects the work a lot.
And I really like to be able to access an audience that's not just into art museums and art galleries. I love to access the general public that's not as crazy about art as I am. So I'm so glad that it's at the Art Center. The Monon's right there. And it's a great audience to access.
Excellent. So there's a lot of other great artists that are going to be part of this as well. Sarah, why don't you tell me a bit about who else is participating this year?
So, yeah, we have a lot of great local artists. William Denton Ray is going to be participating. He is going to do a flag arrangement kind of in a wave formation on the ground. He's actually going to be quite close to Chad's piece, so you'll be able to check his out. Quincy Owens is also another favorite of the community. He's doing
Of course, everyone knows Quincy right now for his whale that's part of the IMA's mini golf course.
Yes, yes. I haven't gotten out to see the whale yet, but I'm pretty awesome. Quite excited too. He's going to do a lighting piece up within the trees. Luke Crawford is also doing one. He's going to do more of a an installation piece with bike pumps, and it'll be interactive. And I think there's going to be sound involved some way, shape, or form, if I know Luke. So that will be quite interesting to see the kids, you know, take a look at that. And then Emily Bennett was the one who was doing the hammocks in the trees.
The hammocks in the trees.
Yes.
That'll be awesome.
Yes.
Great. So what sort of events you have tied in with us, Megan?
We'll have some food trucks there, of course.
For the opening?
Yeah, absolutely. Der Pretzelwagen will be there, and another truck called Big Ron's Bistro. So we'll have some food available to people who come in. And it, we'll also have Sun King Brewing Beer. We'll be serving them and get some tasty Wemax for those who can. Other than that, we'll we're going to have some, I believe we're going to have a DJ.
DJ is on the books, yep. And then one of our sponsors, the Buckingham Foundation, they will be on the on the portico promoting, you know, what they do, helping the families.
Sure.
We're going to have an installation right there that we've developed for them so that people come up and talk to the Buckingham Foundation. Kid-friendly, there's going to be a board, and there's some string involved. I don't know quite all the details. Brian Short is taking care of that. So
very cool.
Yes, it'll be a good event.
And of course, if people miss the opening, they can come anytime through what the end rest of June.
Throughout June and into July a little bit after the July 4th holiday, I think is when deinstallation occurs.
Okay.
And just keep in mind that the Arts Park on the north side of the Indianapolis Arts Center is open, you know, from dawn to dusk, 7 days a week.
And
so, and it's free. You're welcome to bring your dogs there. We get a lot of foot traffic on the Arts Park, and especially during Installation Nation time. So highly recommend people to enjoy the weather.
Now I'm picturing a dog in Chad's
face. Yeah.
So like, what is you could see your own face, but with dog eyes.
Yeah, I want to see that one.
We're going to have to video that.
That'd be awesome. Well, cool. Well, thank you all so much for coming into Art of Matter today. Megan, Sarah, Chad, thanks so much, and best of luck with Installation Nation.
Thanks so much for having us.
Travis DiNicola with Primary Colors, Installation Nation co-chairs Sarah Broadbeck and Megan Reinhardt, and artist Chad Hankins. You can check out the Installation Nation at the opening this Friday, June 17th from 6 to 10 p.m. or anytime through July 8th at the Arts Park at the Indianapolis Arts Center. More information is at primarycolors.org, and that's primarycolours.org, primarycolors.org. You're listening to The Art of the Matter on WFYI 90.1 FM Public Radio.
The Indiana Repertory Theater's Janet Allen is celebrating 20 years at the IRT. Sharon Gamble invited Janet to tell us how she landed in Indy and how she keeps her vision fresh.
Happy Can it be 20th anniversary
Sharon.
To you?
Yikes. Yes, it can, apparently, so I've learned. Yeah, it's the feeling is a combination of sort of I'm feeling very blessed. I'm feeling a little frightened by what they're going to do at the 20th anniversary event in June. I think that could be a little scary, and I'm feeling a bit like a dinosaur.
Is there a roast on the horizon?
Well, they're not calling it a roast,
okay.
But I know nothing about its content. It is to be a surprise to me, which of course scares me heartily. So.
Well, anybody who has the directing chromosome, it does not like surprises.
No,
surprises are anathema to directors.
It makes me very nervous that I'm not producing it. How's that for control freaks? Yeah, there it is.
You know, your board and your staff and your and your patrons would be horrified if you had any other position than the one you just took.
I guess so, Sharon. That's what they pay me to do,
right?
I guess.
Exactly.
Yes, indeed.
So remind us, because there are a lot of people who don't know about an IRT without Janet Allen. Remind
oh
us of what were you, where you came from before?
Yeah. Immediately before my IRT sojourn, I was at Indiana University in graduate school and started, it was my first job out of graduate school, and I came to the IRT to work for Tom Haas as a dramaturg. And then I moved to New York.
Pause for a second
for people
who don't know what a dramaturg does.
Well, a dramaturg is a research and development person, kind of applying scholastic skills like history research, text exploration for directors, actors, for study guides, for programs. So I was a writer and a researcher mostly. Then I left to go to New York for a handful of years, and that was very edifying to me, very eye-opening about what the rest of the world was like. I worked like crazy, and I didn't make a dime. And that's how it kind of goes in New York sometimes, or used to at least. And I came back as associate artistic director under Tom, who then died very prematurely. And then Libby Apple was hired, and I remained as associate artistic director and learned just new boatloads of wonder from her. And then was fortunate enough to succeed her. And I know how long I've been artistic director, Sharon, because I got pregnant right after I became artistic director. And my child is almost 20. So there you go.
What led you to theater?
You know, it was a combination of so many things that I loved. I thought as a small child that what I wanted to do more than anything was teach children how to read.
Really?
So I thought that I would be a third grade teacher or something, and I taught all the neighborhood kids how to read or helped them. I'm sure I did not single-handedly teach them to read. But what it was for me ultimately was that just joy of exploring language. And exploring story and exploring the emotional connection between language and story and how we feel about ourselves. So I think that was it. And also then when I got to high school and started doing it, it was the hardest thing to do.
Theater was the hardest thing to do?
Yeah, it wasn't.
Why?
Well, because science and math, there's a right or wrong answer.
Oh.
And all that ambiguity that comes with making a piece of art, and there's no right or wrong way, I found utterly fascinating. It was all interpretation. It's all opinion. It's all about a group of people exploring something together. So it's also like going on a big hike, right, with a bunch of people.
And it's a big responsibility because you're leading those people.
It is.
Literally in a hike and emotionally, psychologically, intellectually in a theater production.
It is. And just from the personal standpoint, I was so blessed to have two totally opposite, brilliant artistic director mentors who I worked under and learned from day in and day out.
How would you summarize what you learned from Tom Haas?
Creative, quixotic brilliance. You know, Tom was absolutely, I don't want to say unreliable. That's the word that comes. That's not right.
Unpredictable?
Tom was so unpredictable, yes. He was just artistic genius at work, and some days it was so brilliant you just couldn't lap it up fast enough. And other days, if he was flat or he couldn't see his way in, he'd walk out of a rehearsal room and say to me or to a stage manager sometimes, here, you do it. Because he was inspiration generated entirely. So there was never a dull day with Tom. Never. And there was very little routine.
To the good and to the bad.
Yeah. So I learned about the necessity for a great midline. You know, you have to be more. It's got to be more. You know what you're getting into every day as a worker. So I learned a lot about continuity and how staffs need to be managed in a little bit more even-handed manner. From Lib, oh my gosh, well, I learned how women lead differently.
And?
You know, I don't even know that I can characterize it. It's more about gathering people, Sharon. I think it's more about kind of creating a family. It's about listening differently. It's about collective voice, I think, more just in general terms, although I know many men who are brilliant at collective voice. So I don't want to be too genderist about this. But her gift to me was I was at an age where I didn't think I needed another mentor. I was a big old grown-up, Sharon, when I got Libby. And
The universe thought differently.
Well, and that was such a beautiful gift because it was unexpected. I was not ready to lead myself at that point. And so the gift of 4 years with her is that by the end of it, I was.
So you're sounding like a big old grown-up right now
with a
lot of
self-knowledge.
But I'm curious, something that's always fascinated me. I remember once asking a high-profile conductor, how do you know you're ready to record a certain work? It was Brahms' Fourth Symphony, and he said, you're never ready, you just do it.
Right.
Has that been true as a theater artist? Because I sometimes, you know, we all go to somebody's kids or our honorary nephew's high school production of Hamlet and watch it and go, oh, those kids have no idea what they're saying yet. How do you deal with needing more knowledge of the world at any given point than you have?
Well, it's purely trial and error, Sharon. That's the crazy part. And as you know, we work on deadlines so completely that you're always trying to figure out how far you have to back up the clock to gain what. I'll give a great example about next season. So we've been working on this bicentennial play, Finding Home, for 3 years. Now, it hasn't actually started to look anything like a play until about the last 2 months. And it's now starting to resemble a play, which is great. But just, we had a big creative team meeting of the seven of us who have been collaborating as text builders on this now for some time. And I was all on the, okay, if we need this, we have to decide today. If we need that, we can decide in a month. Mm-hmm. It's sort of knowing when and how loudly the clock ticks for various needs.
And having a sense of how long the process will take with this particular group of creative people.
But also, you know, if you knew every risk, you'd never make this stuff. You'd just never do it. You'd run screaming into the hills.
You'd do something else for a living.
Yeah. So I remain very Pollyanna-ish about a lot of things where I say, we can do this. Mm-hmm. We're just going to roll up our sleeves and do it. We have a lot of smart people at the table, and that will out. Mm-hmm. That will make it. Mm-hmm. So you're never ready. I agree. You're never ready, but you get ready. You try to figure out how to get readier and readier all the time, because our promise to an audience is when they walk in the door, we are ready.
Yeah, that famous theater saying, if we're open, we're ready.
Yeah.
It's opening night, we're ready.
Yeah. And, you know, defining what ready means is a huge piece of a puzzle, and we do tremendous heavy lifting in previews. I mean, sometimes the first preview, we're totally ready. We don't have to do very much. Mm-hmm. But more often than not, we're doing masses of work in previews. Now, subscribers, donors, ticket buyers will often say, well, it's perfect after the first preview. How can there be anything else to do? Mm-hmm. But that's why we do it, because we're doing refining of the edges in ways that will make it sturdier, shine brighter, be clearer, all those things. You know?
Well, and it's also why, and I've watched you do this, directors and producers stand at the back of their theater and watch, sometimes night after night, maybe through every single night of a run, because it's a different play every night, because the audience is different. You
know? It is. I will say that in our world, we don't watch every night of a run because we have to move on to the next thing.
Well, sure.
So, actually, I highly discourage that. And actually, our union regulations and our hiring practices preclude it, because most of the time the director is from out of town and they leave the next morning.
Well, yeah, there you go.
So I usually only am dipping my head back in for two reasons. If there's a problem, because the stage manager has identified it, or if I just need to fill myself up a little bit with watching an audience react, and that fills me. That if I'm really depleted or frustrated, if I stand in the back of the theater and watch an audience lead in and say, then I gain energy from that. That gets me ready to do it another day. Watching how it, I can't watch the work I direct after it opens very much, because all I can see is its flaws. But my job is to watch other people's work and see how we can continuously improve in art making. And so I do that once in a while.
When you start out to define a season, do you have a list either in your head or literally on a computer screen or on paper that says, I want a comedy, I want a tragedy, I want something more classical, or is it more organic than that?
that part is in my head, Sharon, but I actually continue, I carry around notebooks that I write play titles in. And sometimes it takes us years to get to a play title. Sometimes we never get to those play titles. And sometimes those play titles, by the time we're ready to get to them, are no longer relevant. So there's so many things that change.
The world moved on.
But the genre study part of it, I pretty much keep in my head. Now, I will tell you what we do on whiteboards and as a group is we're looking at our different audience constituencies. We're looking at our adults who are both our really long time dedicated, loyal adult audience, are how we want to attract new adult audiences. We're also looking at our youth audience in really kind of three quadrants. The little teeny ones for our Exploring Stages program are 3 to 8 year olds. Our middle school, younger audiences, and then our high school audiences. And sometimes there's blends between those groups.
Sure, of course.
But that we do very strategically. So that is probably the most conscious way that we start, is by looking at how we want to divvy up the real estate between our various constituents.
I know you're starting with a swashbuckling adventure, Three Musketeers. What fun. And I wanted, we can't begin because we've talked about so many other things. You're going to have to come back to talk about most of the season. But I want you to remind us how you found the stories for your October, mid-October to mid-November, Finding Home Indiana 200, your bicentennial production. How did you find those stories?
We reached out to a group of about 45 writers that we identified with the help of the brilliant Travis DiNicola and the equally brilliant Barb Shoup at Writer Center at Indy Reads. We had concocted a list of writers we were interested in, but knew that it wasn't sort of big enough or full enough and didn't reach various constituencies, and they helped us. Now we are down, 2 years later, to about 30 writers, maybe a tiny bit less than that, but that's a, that's about it, and from which we have taken, solicited, helped them bring us monologue scenes, poems. And then, of course, there's a giant song aspect of Finding Home. Tim Grimm is writing all original music for it, all Indiana-based music. Some of it's people-specific, some of it's kind of historic moment-specific, some of it's more kind of general about the ethos of Indiana. So it's this great, wonderful stew, Sharon, basically, of stuff we have that we're now starting to experiment with its sequencing and how one thing leads to the next and how we want to move the work around between scene and monologues and poems and songs. But it has been absolutely joyous to watch this work develop because we've watched journalists who've never written a play be willing to take on writing a scene. We've watched poets write scenes. We've watched clergy write scenes. Oh, it's just yummy watching writers react to this challenge. And in some instances, we've said, hey, you wrote a monologue. Would you morph this into a scene? And watching people just go, I don't know that I could do that. And then watching them do it with great passion. It's just been thrilling. So the thing is now morphed into two nights. There are two nights of programming. They stand totally alone. You can see one without ever knowing there's another. So we're still just at the beginning of the kind of messaging process of that. But it will exist about 75% different in the two nights. There'll be a little bit of crossover that is same in both nights. But that is thrilling to me because it's plurality of voice. More voices. Yay!
Sharon Gamble with the IRT's Executive Artistic Director, Janet Allen. Janet is celebrating two decades at the IRT, and you can learn all about their 2016-2017 season at irtlive.com. Again, irtlive.com.
Hey, Travis.
Yes, Sharon.
Everybody who's a regular listener knows we are equal opportunity on The Art of the Matter, so we're going to have a Father's Day special edition of our
calendar. Excellent idea.
Yeah,
since we did so much from
we
Mother's
did
Day.
So much from Mom, Bobby. We didn't forget you. Here we go. Here's that calendar we call.
What do we do?
What kind of events do you have for Dad?
You know, a great one coming up on Saturday night, and this is the Shining Light Gala, and it is a benefit for Indiana Youth Group. Sandra Bernhardt, who is hysterical, going to be featured, and this is, again, Friday night at the NCAA Grand Ballroom. You can still get tickets at indianayouthgroup.org. Again, indianayouthgroup.org, and this is going to be a great event to support the LGBTQ youth community and also help raise money for their prevention of youth suicide. And so Sandra Bernhardt on Saturday nights.
So this might be a little sneaky, but you might put a little promissory note in your dad's Father's Day card and say, Dad, I'm going to take you to the Grand Canyon.
You could. That'd be a nice thing to do.
Or you might just say it's going to cost you a lot less than you think and take your dad to the Eiteljorg where you can see the Grand Canyon, that fabulous exhibit that explores the people, history, and culture of the Grand Canyon, all sorts of beautiful artwork and photographs and activities you can take part in, a visitor comment wall, an in-gallery photo op location so you can fool the rest of your family into thinking you were actually there. That's right. Without all the stress on dad's back and knees of climbing up and down all that. Now, you really, if you have the resources, you really should take dad to the actual Grand Canyon. Mm-hmm. But maybe by way of preparation, go see the Grand Canyon exhibit at the Eiteljorg.
And this weekend's Indian Market. So you can check that out
as
well.
Exactly.
So there'll be tons of performers and lots of vendors. Mm-hmm. If you're looking for a really interesting, unique gift, you could check out Indian Market this weekend at the Eiteljorg too.
Absolutely.
Another idea, if you're looking for a gift for Dad for a last-minute thing, the second annual Indie Art Swap is taking place on Saturday.
You did that last year.
1 o'clock. Yeah, it's at the Art Museum. And really fun event. Basically, what happens is if you've got some art, whether you're an artist or have bought local art or any other art for that matter, and you've got something that you want to swap, you basically take out a blanket and your artwork, and you sit down on the lawn at the IMA and offer it for swapping. And if there's some other work that you see, that a lot of local artists brought their work last year, everything from sketches and paintings and sculpture and pottery, and we're trading with each other. But there are also a lot of people who just brought work that they had collected or found or whatever over the years, and we're swapping out, and no money exchanged. It's just a art swap.
And I bet a lot of interesting conversations that start out.
Very much so. Where did that come from? Yeah.
Yeah.
So again, that starts at 1 o'clock at the IMA for the second annual Indie Art Swap.
Speaking of interesting ideas at the IMA and interesting people, congratulations to Scott Stulen, but we will miss you.
Miss so much.
Thanks
yeah.
for giving us 2.5 years of your ideas as curator of visitor
He's
experience.
He's going off to Tulsa.
Yeah, a curator of audience experience, yes. I should say. Yeah, yes, indeed.
But great job.
Hey, so you say your dad is into something more down-to-earth, like he likes to eat and drink? Okay, mm-hmm. Listen up.
Sure.
At the Indiana State Museum, you can attend Asian Fest this Saturday from 11 a.m. to 4 p.m. Enjoy food from local Asian restaurants, merchandise vendors, Asian-themed games, and various cultural activities and performances, all the way from henna art to calligraphy to yoga, etc., etc. Obviously, Asia encompasses a great many cultures and identities, and you can learn about all of them at Asia Fest at the Indiana State Museum this Saturday. And then, not that they won't sell beverages there, but you might want to head over after that to Brouhaha on the street in front of the Phoenix Theater, 3 to 7. But you do want to score your ticket very soon, because that's been selling out the last few years. Go to phoenixtheater.org. It's obviously a 21 and over event. It's a block party. There's music. But the main reason you go is more than 50 of the best local and national craft breweries will have 3 to 5 samples apiece of their brews. So taste some new beer. And if you have a dad, take dad with you.
There you go. Perfect thing to do on Saturday. Mm-hmm. Something else to check out on Saturday is a new print shop and artist cooperative that is opening up called Cathead Press Print Shop and Artist Cooperative. Dominic Senebaldi is doing it, and it's located in the heart of the Englewood neighborhood, which is a great place, and they are having their grand opening on Saturday. And a lot of other events that are going on in the Englewood neighborhood on Saturday as well that is coinciding with. Should be cool to check out.
Mm-hmm. So maybe you want to give Dad a little special experience on down the road. On July 2nd from 11 a.m. to 9 p.m., some of the city's most unusual restaurants come together for a one-day festival on Monument Circle. It's called Taste of Indy. And it blends a wide variety of our local restaurants, including Greek, Mediterranean, Cajun, Latino, et cetera, with family-friendly games and activities, local music, et cetera, something for everybody. So put a little IOU in Dad's card and take him to Taste of Indy, July 2nd, 11 to 9.
The Symphony has started their lunch break series again, which is very fun. So you can bring a bagged lunch and grab a seat and enjoy lunch while the ISO plays some great shows, some great concerts. They're 40-minute concerts, just $5. So that's nice and affordable. No extra fees or anything like that. You can get them on tickets online or at the door. They just started this week, but they continue next week. They're on Thursdays and at 12:15. So it gives you a little time to get out of the office and get over to the Hilbert Circle Theater. Next week is A Taste of Classical Favorites. And then on Thursday, the 30th, the ISO and the Idle Jorg, we talked about the Idle Jorg before, they're going to be celebrating the Grand Canyon with music. So more Grand Canyon music. And then Mozart on July 7th and John Williams on July 14th and music of Billy Joel and Elton John on the 21st Ooh. Of July. So this continues on through the summer, their lunch break series concert. It's the ISO 12:15 on Thursdays.
You say your dad is a stylish guy. We'll go ahead and get him a tie, but also take him to, drumroll please, 19 Stars of Indiana Art, a bicentennial celebration at the Indianapolis Museum of Art. And you want to go there because it includes fantastic objects all the way from Robert Indiana's 1966 love sculpture through Michael Graves' amazing Nana teapot that you've probably seen in two out of three friends' houses on the stove, et cetera, including some paintings. So something else to do with Dad, 19 Stars of Indiana Art at the IMA.
Cool. Hey, last thing I've got, if you want to go on a road trip, check out the Richmond Shakespeare Festival in Richmond, Indiana. It's going on now through the 26th of June with Comedy of Errors and Tragedy of King Lear. And of course, you can always learn more about local arts events at the indiearts.org guide website, the Arts Council of Indianapolis's Indie Arts Guide, or listen to us on that calendar we call
What'll We Do? Happy Father's Day.
You're listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Indianapolis and Central Indiana. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. If your arts organization has an event or activity of which you think we should be aware, please contact us at least 3 weeks in advance. You can write us at The Art of the Matter, care of WFYI, 1630 North Meridian Street, Indianapolis, Indiana, 46202. Or you can email us at artofthematter@wfyi.org. You can also hear The Art of the Matter on WFYI.org.
Last week, the Indianapolis Art Center's biennial Art from the Heartland exhibition opened, featuring work from contemporary Midwest artists. Travis DiNicola spoke with the Art Center's Director of Exhibitions, Kyle Harrington, and art consultant, Mindy Taylor Ross, who juried the show, about the exhibit.
Mindy, Kyle, welcome to Art of the Matter. Great to have you both here.
Thanks for having us, Travis.
Thanks. We love coming talking to you.
Absolutely. Hey, this is a very cool show that's going on all summer long at the Indianapolis Arts Center. Kyle, I want to start with you as the Arts Center's curator. Give me a little bit of background on this. This is a regular event that you guys do.
Yeah, Art from the Heartland is a show that we have every 2 years, mm-hmm. and it's sort of our survey on what's going on in the art world around the Midwest. I believe they had the show kind of regularly a while ago, but since I've been at the Art Center for 7 years, this is the fourth incarnation of it, starting in 2012 and then every 2 years since then. So,
and in the past, it would feature artists not just from Indiana, but from all the neighboring states. But
yes.
This year, it's actually expanded even beyond that.
Yeah, right? So we expanded it this year in terms of the states that the artists were from. In the past, since 2012, we've had it in half of our galleries, mm-hmm. and I rearranged the schedule to have it in all of the galleries now. That's
nice.
Because the quality of the artwork that was getting submitted was so high, and we could only take so much because of how space would allow us to fit things in there. And I would get so bummed out that we would have to turn away pieces that were so strong. So I was able to rearrange the schedule and open up all of the galleries at the Art Center for the show. And because of that, we decided to move it into Missouri, Minnesota, and Iowa as well. So sort of like Midwest expanded, which is really cool. And there's a lot of really great work in the show from those states. So I'm glad we opened that up.
So you had submissions from, what, like something like 650 different artists for this?
Yep. Yeah, we had 650 pieces submitted. Okay. So they submit a particular piece. Each artist can submit two pieces.
Okay.
In 2012, when we first relaunched the show, I believe we had 300 pieces submitted. So it's grown considerably every year. And the pool of artwork has been really amazing.
And it's all types of artwork, right?
Oh, yeah. So we've got, you know, ceramics, sculpture, drawing, painting, printmaking, video we've got. And another reason why we opened up all of the galleries is so that we could include installation this year, which is really awesome.
Oh,
because
very cool.
We've had a lot of really good installations submitted in the past, but we just didn't have the space to be able to pull the trigger on those. So
to be clear on one thing, the installations that are part of this are different from the installation nation that's going to be going on.
Oh,
as
yeah.
Well.
Yeah. Those are different. So these are more internal-based installations.
Right. Installation nation is pretty much all outside.
Right.
And stuff. Okay. So. Very cool. Were there any other parameters as far as what you were asking of the artists?
It's pretty wide open. So the only requirements are you have to be 18 or older and live in one of those states, either surrounding Indiana or Minnesota, Missouri, or Iowa. Other than that, logistically, we have to be able to actually put it up. But really, we don't put a lot of requirements on there because this is our chance to kind of cast a really wide net and see what sticks, which is really exciting.
So, Mindy.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that was your job, right?
Yes.
I mean, to select the 80 or some pieces out of
this? Yes, out of the 650. So Kyle made my job really tough.
Okay, so how do you go about narrowing it? I mean, what sort of criteria do you use then to, you know, to select? I mean, are you trying to be representative of each state? Is that part blind? Are you trying to get a wide variety of art or a certain theme? Or, I mean, how do you go about doing that?
Yeah, great questions. First and foremost, I wanted to know from the Art Center sort of their goals and thoughts about the purpose of this exhibition. And, you know, Kyle kind of said it best when he said it really is about casting a net and showcasing the best and brightest working in all genres of art, of visual art in the Midwest and in the states he mentioned. So I first attacked it kind of from that standpoint, you know, so it can be, you know, traditional. It can be very, very modern, postmodern, and contemporary, which is can be tricky, too. So in addition to going through 650 submissions, you're also really flipping back and forth between looking at things that can be very traditional and then things that are very postmodern. But for me, when I look at art, I really am looking for, first and foremost, kind of formal rigor. So line and color and these sorts of aesthetic issues, but then conceptual rigor. You know, does the artist really have a point of view? You know, are they successfully getting that point of view across? And the other thing I think that informed this show for me is a lot of the work really had social and political commentary to it. I mean, it's a huge and important election year, and I found myself being drawn to that.
Yeah.
I don't know if you found that,
yeah,
Kyle.
Yeah, I noticed that.
Yeah, and I couldn't kind of escape it, so I have to admit that I think a little bit of my perspective as a juror of the show probably welcomed the artists who were dealing with a lot of what's happening in the world today.
Now, Mindy, are you looking at just photographs, slides, what have you, or do you also get to look at an artist statement or anything like that to help inform your choice?
Yeah, to go back to that question, I'm sorry. So the jury is blind, so I don't get to see people's names or necessarily where they're from.
So you don't know what state they're from at all?
No. I'm looking at everything digitally, which I will also say can be a bit of a challenge, frankly. But is awesome because that way I can do it on my own time and really get through things at my own pace. But I see images, digital images, and I do have access to an artist statement or blurbs of what the artist kind of wants to say about the piece.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
So and then the basic kind of formal, what's it made from, what's the size of it, that kind of thing.
So, Kyle, am I right that more than half of the pieces selected are from Indiana artists?
Yeah, and I don't actually know if Mindy knew that until,
I know.
until just now.
You might
now.
Be dragging out details that I don't know since it is all blind.
But that's a really exciting element about this show
I thought so,
to
too. I mean, that's kind of, I mean, if it is blind and you're not, like, trying to pick, oh, we've, you know, so many from Indiana, so many from Ohio, so many from Michigan, the fact that more than half of the ones that were selected are Indiana artists?
Yeah, and it's such a great point with this show, and it makes me really excited and proud for Indiana because I think, you know, when I very first joined the Art Center and started getting involved in this show, you know, I will admit part of me was like, oh, it's probably just going to be all Chicago artists because, you know, having something that's open to artists from, you know, bigger art cities in your mind, you would think, okay, well, it's going to be all of these types of artists. But Indiana art is holding up really well. Over half of the artists in the show are from Indiana, and a large chunk of them are from Indianapolis.
Wow, that's great. I did that.
Which is, yeah, it's really exciting. And that's why I love blind juries, because it really is, you know, I was telling somebody at work today, it's like the great equalizer in my mind, because there's not a lot of bias based on, you know, what's their past like, or what are their connections, and really the juror is really just looking at the work and the content of the work and the execution of the work. And that's really great for me and for somebody that works at somewhere like the Art Center, where we're really wanting to give artists opportunities to show. A lot of artists that I don't know or haven't heard of are in the show, and this is a really great springboard for them to really get involved in the art community when maybe they don't otherwise have the connections and things like that. Yeah. So that's why I really love
it's
a blind
jury. Based on their work.
Yeah, and this is one of my favorite shows to do that with.
And that was one of the exciting things about jurying this show from my perspective, you know, as somebody who lives and works here in central Indiana and gets involved, frankly, in a lot of projects here in Indiana, is I was really fascinated to see this cross-section of work and to want to pick Kyle's brain afterwards, since it was blind, to try to find out who some of these artists are. It was a great way for me as an independent curator to start to source other work by other artists that I may not be familiar with.
So besides some of the political themes, was there any other theme that you saw sort of coming through the work, or maybe anything that people should look for in going to see this show?
You know, I think that was the big one for me. Yeah. I think, especially in terms of kind of the the artists who are working in a postmodern fashion, it's clear that they are holding up a mirror to society today, which is a lot of what great contemporary artists do. And they are really, again, being that mirror about a lot of the social and political things that are happening both in the United States and globally. A lot of work that spoke about war, work around LGBT issues, the election. I mean, there was just a lot of that, don't you think?
Yeah, I think it's reflective of what's going on in people's lives in the Midwest. And I think these are really, more so than East Coast or West Coast, I think these are really formative issues in the heartland of the United States. I mean, we're kind of in the cross section here of all of these back and forth opinions and a lot of really highly divided points of view. And I feel like a lot of creative types and artists are really struggling with how to deal with that turmoil and how to insert themselves into that dialogue. And so I think that being reflected through the artwork is something that's definitely of note. And it's, as I say, the show is reflective of the art that's going on in the Midwest today. And I think that's what's going on in the Midwest today.
Is there
Midwest
a Midwest
today.
Style?
I wouldn't say so.
I wouldn't say so either.
Some of the artists, and again, I didn't have any sway in telling Mindy what to pick or whatever, but I, facilitating the process, I did see all of the entries and things like that. And from what I saw, it didn't look like there was a lot of necessarily this is about the Midwest. Now, we did get some entries that maybe were more...
the more traditional work, of course, that comes out of the Midwest, comes out of more of a Midwestern art history, if you will. Mm-hmm. So, people who paint traditionally in this region are following more of a regionalist tradition that has its, its roots in history. But that, I think, is very specific to the people who are working in kind of traditional landscape painting and that sort of genre. But the postmodern work, I don't think.
Yeah, I think
a Midwest style.
Yeah, I wouldn't say there is a Midwest style. I think it's pretty broad.
So what's at stake here? I know we're recording this before the opening. It's going to air actually after the opening of the awards ceremony. Mm-hmm. But there's some prizes here at stake.
Yeah, so we've got $4,000 worth of awards.
Excellent.
And that's something when we did relaunch the show, or this exhibition in 2012, there wasn't any awards for it. And something that I really try to do as being the director of exhibitions at the Art Center is think about the Art Center's mission, which is to, the Art Center was founded as a way to support working, living artists. Now, it's a lot easier for my coworkers in like our education or outreach departments to tie their work to that mission. So I'm thinking all the time of ways that I can tie our exhibitions to the mission of supporting working artists. And ways that I can do that are offering opportunities for show and opportunities for artists to sell their work, but also providing stipends and prize money to artists that are showing exhibitions. And that's something that really just sweetens the pot when you get into a show. You know, as an artist myself, I've gotten to shows where there's no prizes, and that's great, and just being in the show is exciting. But then when they do offer prizes, that's even more of a way to get amped up and excited about the show.
Yeah, it's enticing. Really, I'm sure, cool. It also helps just increase the quality of the submissions.
Yeah, so we'll have Mindy select from the actual artwork. So she juried all of the work in through the digital images, but when she picks the awards,
be looking at the physical objects.
Yes, yeah. Because as Mindy and I were talking earlier, it's a lot. It's difficult to really get a full sense of the work unless you're seeing it physically in person.
Sure.
Yeah.
So the top prize is $1,500 for first place. There's a second and third place that'll get some cash, and then five jurors' choices as well. And then I get to select two directors' choices, which will get solo shows in the future at the Art Center. And that's a great way for me to see artists as well. And that's a really nice way to add to the shows that I already have in the works, and maybe you know, complement those really nicely with work I wouldn't have known about otherwise.
Yeah, two curators cherry picking.
That's right. It's really
Mindy,
great.
Kyle. It sounds like it's a great show. Can't wait to see it myself in person. Looking forward to it very much. Sounds like something great to check out at the Arts Center this summer. Thanks both for being here.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, Travis.
Travis DiNicola with the Indianapolis Art Center's Director of Exhibitions, Kyle Harrington, and art consultant, Mindy Taylor Ross. The exhibit Art from the Heartland is on display at the Art Center now through August 6th. And for more information, visit indplsartcenter.org, indplsartcenter.org.
Thanks for joining us today. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Bocelli Wallrap Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
Please listen to The Art of the Matter next week, Thursday at 8 p.m. and Saturday at 7 a.m. I'll talk with author Doug Wissing about his new book about Indiana.
Then I'll find out about all the new things the Vonnegut Library has planned this summer.
And I'll get a preview of Bob Harbin's production of Billy Elliot. And we'll have that arts calendar we'll call
What'll We Do? So please listen next weekend to The Art of the Matter here on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio.
You've been listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in central Indiana and Indianapolis. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. Today's show was edited by Melissa Davis and produced by Travis DiNicola. The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you.